Case this morning is State versus Lynn. Mr. Calkins, good morning to you. You may proceed.
Thank you. I guess before I get too much into this, I will just indicate to the court that this is one of the strangest set of facts that I've ever come down to present to the court. And I think what arose out of this, one of the ideas that the state brought up was whether or not the court has jurisdiction. And obviously that's an issue that we have to address before we get anywhere as far as whether there are errors or not. And I think as we go through it, a quick review of the facts will indicate why the court has jurisdiction in this particular circumstance, and also demonstrate why the district court erred in the decision. There were really two parts to what the district court did. The first was forfeiting a bond and entering judgment. There are two separate orders that did that, and that I think out of that, as the state briefed, that they agree that the court does have jurisdiction on that particular part of the appeal, and I believe then also that it should be remanded for hearing, because the forfeiture and the entering of judgments was all done without any due process or without any hearing. So I don't think we have a big argument there. The second part was how the court handled a motion to suppress, and I guess, or how the court treated it, because. And the state, in this instance, is asserting that this is like any other motion to suppress. It was overruled, and therefore, it's not subject to this court's jurisdiction at this point, that we would have to try the case and then appeal. And I think normally I would agree with that. If we had a normal motion to suppress, then I would agree that if it was overruled, that's not a final appealable order at that point. And briefly, what we went through was the motion was set for hearing, and my client failed to appear. And there, at the time of the hearing, I didn't know why he didn't appear. He just wasn't there. And so there wasn't any reason presented to the court. There wasn't a finding of good cause to not be there. There wasn't a finding that he intentionally was avoiding the court. One of the things that I don't know if that's what prompted the reaction from the court, my client is Chinese, requires a special interpreter, and the closest one was Omaha. So we had an interpreter that came clear out from Omaha, and then obviously the court was not pleased that my client wasn't there. The first thing that happened was the court issued a warrant, and I have absolutely no problem with that. I think that was it was certainly the court's prerogative to issue a warrant. And I think then the appropriate thing would have been to have my client arrested on the warrant and hold him in jail until there could be a hearing on the motion to suppress. But I think from that point forward is where the district court erred in everything they did. In essence, we did not have a hearing. There was no opportunity really to speak either by myself or the county attorney. It was a recitation of what was going to happen, and in the end, when I finally had an opportunity, was given an opportunity to speak, my indication was, Judge, I understand you've already ruled on it. For the record, I want the court to be aware that I don't think you can do this, and I'm objecting to these proceedings. And so at that point, his decision was that by not showing up that day, my client had waived his right to a motion to suppress, and he, I guess, overruled the motion to suppress on that basis.
You used the phrase, at this point, and those were the exact words of the judge, weren't they? The judge said, at this point, the motion to suppress will be overruled because I conclude that he waived it. What do we make of that sort of conditional or qualifying language at this point? What does it suggest?
Well, I guess in retrospect, after I filed another one, it meant that he was going to waive it the next time too. And because...
Was your client there?
No, it was summarily overruled without even being set for hearing. So what I did when this was overruled, it was overruled on July 23rd. On July 26th, the first forfeiture order came in, and on July 27th, the second forfeiture order came in because they discovered there was actually more money, and so they amended it and forfeited $20,000 and entered judgment for $200,000. And I, in response to the court's order, I filed a motion to vacate the judgment, a motion to reconsider, and another motion to suppress, and all were summarily overruled as soon as they were filed. So I guess in somewhat of an answer to your question, that is what I don't think he had any intention whatsoever of allowing a motion to suppress at any time by his ruling against or not allowing it on the second time through.
Why should this be immediately reviewable if the garden variety denial of a motion to suppress is not?
To me, the distinction is we didn't have, even if you read the way the court signed the order, we didn't even have a motion to suppress. The court will deem the defendant to have waived his motion to suppress. And so it really isn't a ruling on a motion to suppress. There was no evidence taken. There wasn't even an opportunity given to the state to present evidence. There was no evidence taken. Nothing happened other than we stood there and were told this was what was going to be. I mean, and it happened to both sides. We were both treated equally. But the court said the court will deem the defendant to have waived his motion to suppress, and that motion to suppress is overruled. It isn't totally clear, but to me it appears that what the court is saying is I'm overruling the motion on the fact that your client waived it. And if you haven't had a motion to suppress, then how can you have, it's basically he's been denied that. It's not a garden variety overruling a motion to suppress after hearing the evidence. It's saying there isn't going to be a motion to suppress.
Why could that issue not be reviewed after the conclusion of a trial?
Well, I think it substantially prejudices my client to not, if you have a motion to suppress and you're allowed to have evidence presented and at least get your side presented, you've at least been afforded due process, you've been able to go through the process. In this instance, I think it substantially impairs my client's due process and puts him in a much worse situation going into a trial without an opportunity to, if he had a motion to suppress, there may not be a trial.
Is he prejudiced because of the forfeiture? Is he prejudiced with respect to the evidence for a potential trial?
Well, I think the forfeiture clearly was, he's prejudiced because it was, everything was forfeited without any hearing. On the motion to suppress, I think he's substantially prejudiced because of the court deeming that he had waived it. I mean, he wasn't there, admittedly, but there was never an inquiry to me, or had I talked to him, did he intend to waive it by not being there? The court just summarily ruled, I'm ruling that he waived his motion to suppress because he didn't show up.
Counsel, you're not taking an absolutist position that a defendant can never waive a suppression motion by failing to show up repeatedly. In other words, you're relying on the particular facts here, not that a trial judge ultimately can decide, even if the defendant keeps failing to show up, he's in effect waiving the suppression.
Well, the one case that we found that we cited, you know, it gave an opportunity later, and that defendant failed to take affirmative action to bring in evidence later, and the court ruled that could be deemed a forfeiture, and then it was a question of was that counsel's fault or was it the defendant's fault. But I think, and I guess obviously this is my client in this instance, so I'm really looking at the facts in this circumstance, and I don't think that with this particular defendant, that we have a, we don't have that pattern of showing that he's basically in contempt of court for not showing up. We had no idea why, at that time, we had no idea why he wasn't there that day.
Pardon me.
The other question I had is, assuming you get to trial, and you've been denied the opportunity to make a record on the motion to suppress, wouldn't you still have an opportunity at trial to make an offer of proof as to what the motion to suppress hearing would have shown had you been permitted to proceed?
I considered that, and the idea of the jurisdiction at this time is affecting a substantial right, and I think you could say yes, you have that, but I think you have that opportunity, but I think it impairs your trial to such an extent that it is substantially impairing a defendant's right.
Counsel, before you sit down, the bench warrant that was issued at the second failure to appear, is that still outstanding?
Yes, as far as I know.
Right. And then your client assigned some of his bond proceeds after he posted that, one to a bail bond company and some to counsel. Were the parties who held assignments of those bond monies noticed on the forfeiture?
No, as far as I know, there was no notice given to anyone.
Okay, thank you.
It was just, there were just documents presented to the court and they were signed. I never received any notice.
With respect to immediately appealable issue, without generalizing too much, we have held, other courts generally have held, that occasionally it's something, a ruling is immediately appealable if it's kind of momentous or with respect to a constitutional right, some other caveats. How do you fit into that jurisprudence at this time?
Well, I think, and I didn't take filing this appeal lightly, I will tell you that. I did look at all of those issues, and I think that what I was looking at with that is that this is, number one, I've never heard of a ruling like this before in a circumstance like this, but I think it was, as far as my client's rights were concerned, it would be a momentous act to him. It would be something far out of the ordinary and would greatly affect his due process rights and how the trial would consider or would go forward from that point. So I felt like it was far outside of the normal set of circumstances.
Could this year court went forward with the motion to suppress hearing and treated your client's failure to appear as a waiver of his right to participate?
Excuse me?
Could the district court have went ahead with the motion to suppress hearing and treated his failure to appear as a waiver of his right to participate in that hearing?
Yeah, I'm not sure, I guess, to be honest with you, and because I haven't really found anything that would give me the answer as far as case law, and some that was a consideration as well. Or could the court have just said, I'm going to waive his appearance and then proceeded with the motion to suppress? That potentially could have been another option, but we didn't get that far because the court just ruled by not being there, he just waived his right. And I felt like if it was on that particular day that was overruled, I think the judge made his intentions clear when he summarily overruled all the other motions and motions to vacate and motions to reconsider immediately afterwards. So I think, to me, it became clear as far as how this court could look at it that he had no intention whatsoever of granting a motion to suppress at any time.
In any future proceedings in this matter, will be held in front of a different judge because that judge is retired, correct?
He is retired now, yes. Any other questions? Not. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. List, good morning to you.
May it please the court, Nathan List, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee of the state of Nebraska. As far as the denial of the motion to suppress, we maintain that this court lacks jurisdiction over these claims since a final order has not been entered. We acknowledge that the district court's basis for denying the motion is problematic, or at least potentially problematic. But it doesn't change the fact that in our view, a final order has not been entered, and as noted in our brief, and as Justice Frydenberg just mentioned, the trial judge that denied the motion has in fact retired, so it's entirely conceivable that when this goes back down, resumes at the trial level, that the new presiding judge will entertain the motion. So we would submit that jurisdiction is lacking on that claim. As far as the forfeiture of Lynn's bond, I think that this issue raises two primary questions before this court. Number one, is a bond forfeiture final and appealable? And number two, if it is final and appealable, was Lynn's bond properly forfeited? As far as the first question, whether a bond forfeiture is final and appealable, we maintain that it is, or at least that it appears to be, under Section 25-1911. The appellate court has jurisdiction over a judgment or a final order. The district court's order in this case could arguably qualify as either, could qualify as a judgment, because under 29-1108 and 1109 of our recognizance forfeiture statutes, those statutes specifically say that if a forfeiture of recognizance is not set aside, the court shall enter a judgment of default and execution, and the forfeiture may be executed. So by statute, this seems to contemplate a judgment, which in and of itself would appear to be appealable. It could also qualify as a final order in a special proceeding based on the reasons set forth in the Court of Appeals opinion in State v. Hernandez, this court's recent decision in State v. McCallery. And by analogy, I would note that at least in the context of forfeiture of seized property in State v. AG, this court noted that an order forfeiting property is most appropriately characterized as a final order in a special proceeding. So under that line of case law, it could arguably be a final order in a special proceeding as well. If I had to weigh in on which one I think it is, I would probably say that in our view it's a judgment. I understand that the statute's use of the word judgment is not dispositive. Our post-conviction statute, for instance, calls something a judgment, but it's final and appealable because it's actually a final order in a special proceeding. I went back and reviewed those cases and the rationale there, and the explanation is that it's a special proceeding because a civil proceeding outside of Chapter 25, and it's not itself an action. But looking back at the recognizance statutes in question, they do say that this is an action. 29-1105 calls this an action, and then again, 29-1108 and 1109 contemplate a judgment being entered at the conclusion of that action. So it seems to me that it would probably most appropriately be a judgment in an action, and thus be final and appealable on that basis. But either way, in our view, it does appear to be final and appealable, so we're not disputing that. This court has jurisdiction. As far as the second question of whether Lynn's bond was properly forfeited, the answer appears to be no, assuming this court agrees with the rationale and the Court of Appeals opinion in the State v. Hernandez. There should have been some type of hearing on the issue, and Lynn should have been afforded some opportunity to dispute the forfeiture. So, assuming that should have happened, we acknowledge that it didn't.
Are there any statutes in Nebraska that provide any guidance with respect to what sort of process is due at a hearing on a forfeiture?
No, I've looked through those and as well as our case law, and I mean it's not real clear. For instance, in State v. Seton, an actual trial was held on the matter, whereas in like Hernandez and Convalar, if I'm saying that right, or Convalin, it was just a hearing. So I'm not entirely sure, and the statutes don't really give us much guidance. They just talk about the fact that if a bond has been breached, it shall be forfeited, and then you have the statutes dealing with the possibility of setting it aside. But there's no explanation in there about the process, the timeline for a set-aside process, or any of that. So I've struggled with that in terms of what really makes sense in terms of the statute, and practically speaking, how you'd go about this. And I guess there's really only one or two alternatives. You kind of do this all at once, where you enter a sort of an order of forfeiture with a presumption of forfeiture, and then the litigant can come in and dispute it, and you have sort of a set-aside hearing and look at whether or not any of that should be set aside, and if not, you enter your judgment. Or you just have the hearing on the forfeiture, whether or not it should be forfeited, and then at some point after that, they can come in and seek to set aside that judgment if they want. The statutes, honestly, to me, could be read either way. One part of the statute talks about, it says, if the forfeiture is not set aside, we should enter the judgment, which seems to contemplate doing the set-aside consideration first. But then there's the very last statute in the series says, well, you can do a set-aside after the judgment has been entered. So honestly, Your Honor, I don't know. Exactly.
Those,
I think you could do it either way.
As you see it, those are the paths to the process.
Right, right. And I mean, I think either would be sufficient, either would be consistent with the statutes.
Is there any guidance from the United States Supreme Court on the process due in a forfeiture proceeding generally?
The fact that you've asked leads me to believe that they've said
something.
I'm just
asking.
Oh, okay, I know.
Yeah, that wasn't a lob or anything.
I don't know, Your Honor, if they've spoken on it. I don't know.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I guess we would ask for clarification on whether this is final appealable and the process that should take place. I guess the only other quick point I would make, assuming this is going to go back for a hearing, is I guess the standard, what, assuming a hearing is going to be held and evidence or arguments considered, what exactly is the standard to be applied here? And I think from our case law, it would be an abuse of discretion standard. That seems to be what Seton and the Convalin case say. Seton does also talk about it being equitable in nature and that equitable considerations are what govern. I'm not entirely sure I agree with that, given that equity typically only comes into play when you don't have a remedy at law, and here I think you do. So I think that this should be a legal question, a legal process, and I think the abuse of discretion standard as a matter of law would be appropriate and provide a workable standard of review on appeal for what it's worth. So, if there are no further questions, we'll submit the matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? No, there is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day, then, is Abbe LLC versus Nebraska Liquor Control Commission.